Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN, the Independent Voter News. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests, so you can develop your own more informed opinion. My guest today is Ilya Soman, professor of law at George Mason University. Professor Soman's research focuses on constitutional law, property law, democratic theory, federalism, and migration rights. He has been widely published in scholarly journals and has also been featured in The New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Time, Newsweek, and The Economist, just to name a few, as well as on CBS, MSNBC, NPR, BBC, Reuters, Al Jazeera, and Voice of America, again, just to name a few. In addition, Mr. Soman's writings have been cited in decisions by the Supreme Court of the United States and other federal courts, multiple state Supreme Courts, and the Supreme Court of Israel. And he's testified before Congress on two separate occasions. He joins me today to discuss his latest book entitled Free to Move, Foot Voting, Migration, and Political Freedom, which I found to be quite interesting. So welcome to Deconstructed, Ilya.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ilya, there are a lot of listeners who may not be familiar with the term foot voting, so let's start there. What is foot voting in a generic sense?
Sure. We normally think of voting at the ballot box as the way we choose the government policies that we want to live under. We vote for the Democrats or the Republicans, for example, but we can also do so by voting with our feet. And there's actually three ways that we can do that. One is by voting with our feet in a federal system. We can decide what state or local government we want to live in, at least in part, based on the government policies there. Another one is through international migration. The United States is populated by people or the descendants of people who moved here, at least in part, to escape harmful and oppressive government policies elsewhere. And finally, there are many situations where we can make choices in the private sector, where there are private organizations that provide goods and services similar to those that are provided by particularly state and local governments. For example, private planned communities such as condominiums. And here too, you can vote with your feet. What really differentiates voting with your feet from voting at the ballot box is that when you vote at the ballot box, your vote is almost always just one vote out of many thousands or many millions. And so your chance of affecting the outcome is very, very low. On the other hand, when you vote with your feet, if you're allowed to do so, you actually have a very high chance of being able to actually change the policies that you have to live under. And that makes foot voting quite different from ballot box voting, even though there's the important similarity in both cases. You're choosing what government policies you want to live under, or at least trying to make a decision like that.
Would you suggest that foot voting is more decisive and maybe there's an incentive to make a more informed decision than there is in ballot box voting?
Yes, you've summarized it very well. Foot voting has two very important advantages over ballot box voting, and those advantages are related to each other. One is that when you vote with your feet, you have a much, much higher chance of being able to make a difference to the outcome. In an American presidential election, for example, there's only about a 1 in 60 million chance that your vote will determine the outcome. There's a higher chance in a state or local election, but it's still pretty low. And it's hard to argue that you have meaningful freedom of choice when you have only a 1 in 1 million or 1 in 60 million chance of making a difference. By contrast, when you vote with your feet, you have a much higher chance of making a difference and therefore more genuine freedom of choice. And in part because of that, when people vote at the ballot box, they have very little incentive to seek out relevant information. Why would you spend an enormous amount of time seeking out information about a decision that is highly unlikely to make a difference? And in fact, lots of evidence shows most voters know very little about what they're voting on when they vote at the ballot box. By contrast, when you vote with your feet, you know that the choice will make a difference, and therefore there's much more incentive to seek out information. If you're like most people, you probably spent more time searching for information and thinking about it the last time you decided what TV set to buy than the last time you decided who to vote for president or for any other political office. That's not because the TV set is more important than the presidency or deals with more difficult issues. It's because you know that the TV you choose is probably the one that will actually end up in your living room. But when you turn it on and you have the misfortune to see a politician like the president or a governor or somebody else, you know that the chance you can affect who that is extremely low. And therefore, you spend much less time and effort on learning information relevant to that decision. So when you vote with your feet, you both have a bigger chance of making a difference and therefore more genuine freedom of choice. And also for that very reason, you're more likely to seek out relevant information and think about it carefully.
You have a wonderful term in your book, and that's rational ignorance. And I think that's a bit of what you've been defining in that last answer. Beyond the fact that it's more convenient, why do people not take their vote more seriously?
Rational ignorance, full disclosure, is not my original term. It's a term economists have used for many years. And the basic idea there is that we all have limited time and energy. So we can't seek out all the information in the world. We can only seek out probably a small subset of it. And so we're more likely to seek out information when the information is relevant to a choice that has a high chance of making a difference than when the information is relevant to a choice that has only a very tiny chance of making a difference. And with rare exceptions, most ballot box voting decisions are situations where the chance of your one vote making a difference are incredibly small. And therefore, it's actually rational to devote very little time and effort to seeking out information. By contrast, foot voting decisions are ones that at least very often will make a big difference, and therefore you have more incentive to seek out information. The example of buying a TV set versus voting for president is just one example of that contrast, but also more relevant to the topic of the book is an example like deciding which town or which state you're going to live in, deciding whether you're going to move from your country to another one, if you're allowed to do so. Those are decisions that make a big difference with respect to what kind of government policies you actually live under, and therefore you have more incentive to research them and think about them carefully. And lots of evidence, both experimental and historical, shows that when people vote with their feet, they do in fact seek out more evidence and use it more wisely than when they vote at the ballot box.
What is your fundamental premise when it comes to foot voting, if you could frame it in a succinct manner?
Foot voting, as compared to ballot box voting, enables us to make choices that make more of a difference and thereby give us more freedom. And also, they're better informed. I would add to that, though it's a separate sentence, that expanding opportunities for foot voting can massively increase both freedom and welfare for many millions of people around the world, particularly the poorest and most oppressed.
Let's focus on that last point, and let's look at the three different types of foot voting that you discuss in your book. Let's look at interjurisdictional. What are the relative pros and cons of interjurisdictional foot voting?
So interjurisdictional foot vote in a federal system is when you move to a different state or local government. And you know, there's a lot of important advantages. One is that you have more choice. We have 50 states and some 90,000 or so local governments of various kinds. And you can find a wide range of options and potentially find something that fits your needs and preferences really well. Another advantage is that historically, at least, this has been a particular boon to the poor and disadvantaged. Many millions of people have improved their lives by moving to places with greater opportunity. In many cases, oppressed minorities like African Americans fleeing segregation or gays and lesbians fleeing homophobia have managed to move to places that are more tolerant and less discriminatory towards them. And there are many other benefits as well. There obviously are costs. One obvious cost is moving costs, that it can be expensive to move, not just in terms of the money that you have to pay, but also in terms of maybe you have to switch jobs, you might lose connections with your family and friends and the like. And some scholars have argued there are going to be other types of costs, such as races to the bottom and the danger of that. I take these costs seriously, but in the book, I argue that many of them are either overblown or can be addressed in various ways that reduce the problem.
One example of what you just discussed is your distinction between immobile assets and mobile assets. Can you address that?
Sure. So one problem with foot voting, at least if it requires physical movement, is that some things that we own are immobile. That is, we can't take them with us. The most obvious example is property and land. You can't take your land with you. And so that reduces the effectiveness of foot voting because there are some things that you value that you can't take with you. But I would add that this is less of a problem for the poor and disadvantaged, the ones who need foot voting the most, because almost by definition, if you're poor, you're less likely to own some very valuable fixed asset, like a valuable piece of land or something of that sort. But in the book and in my other writings as well, I do propose ways to protect immobile assets against possible downsides of foot voting. For instance, that if it's relatively easy for mobile assets to leave, state and local governments might be tempted to impose tax burdens and other restrictions on the immobile assets that can't escape as easily.
How would you distinguish between interjurisdictional foot voting and private sector foot voting?
Interjurisdictional foot voting is foot voting between different government jurisdictions like states, local governments, and so on. Private sector foot voting, by contrast, is when you switch between different private organizations. For example, you could move from one town to another, one state to another to go to a better public school system. But you could also say, I'm staying where I am, but I'm enrolling my kids in a private school. And similarly, you can, instead of moving to a place with a different police department, you can hire private security services and so on. And in many situations, these private sector options offer more and better alternatives than we get from the public sector alone. And they also often have the advantage of lower moving costs, that often you can vote with your feet in the private sector, even without physically moving at all. For example, I recently enrolled my six-year-old daughter in a private school, and I didn't actually have to buy a house in a new location or move my family. I simply enrolled her in the private school, though there is the issue that we have to pay tuition while simultaneously also paying taxes to support the local public school.
Now, you have a number of elements that are threaded throughout all types of foot voting. One of them is non-domination. Explain non-domination from a foot voting perspective.
In the book, I discuss several different theories of political freedom and explain how foot voting has important advantage over ballot box voting from multiple perspectives, not just one. And one of the perspectives I look at is non-domination, which is a theory developed by a number of prominent political theorists, such as Philip Pettit. And the idea is that a person is free, including politically free, if he or she is not subject to the arbitrary will of another person. So a person living under a dictatorship, they're subject to the will of the dictator. Even more so, a person who's a slave is subject to the will of the slave owner. A slave owner can tell them to do almost anything they want. A dictator like Vladimir Putin can impose all sorts of horrible oppression on people under his rule or all sorts of decisions, and they have little or no recourse. And theorists who emphasize the importance of non-domination, they say that it's especially important that we not be subject to the arbitrary will of other people. And I argue that if this is your perspective, then you should be sympathetic to greatly expanding foot voting rights, in that if you have exit options from various government policies you disapprove of, that greatly reduces the likelihood that you will be subject to the kind of domination these theorists most fear. If you don't like your state or local government policy, if you find it oppressive, you can exit. In the private sector, there's even more powerful exit rights potentially because you don't have to physically move. On the other hand, with ballot box voting is a very weak protection against domination, because even if you have the vote and your vote counts the same as everybody else, still you are effectively dominated in terms of this theory by the decisions of whoever has the support of the majority of the electorate. Your chance of influencing who that is extremely low. And therefore, the ballot box voters have only very limited protection against domination. If you think the fact that you have the same rights as others to participate in that way, that that's enough, then you could also say, imagine an absolute dictator, but every year the dictator holds a lottery. And if you win the lottery, then you get to make certain important policy decisions. So in that lottery, you say have maybe if there are a million people under the dictator's rule, you have a 1 in 1 million chance of being able to influence government policy. But if your number comes up in the lottery, then you're extremely influential. Similarly, if there is a tied election and you break the tie, you have a great likelihood of making a big difference. But the chance that you will, in fact, be able to break the tie is extremely low. Just like there's also only an extremely low chance that your number will come up in the dictator's lottery. And if you're not satisfied with the dictator's lottery, you should be equally skeptical that ballot box voting by itself provides you with sufficient freedom from domination.
Ilya, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about foot voting when we come back. Welcome back. My guest today is Ilya Soman, professor of law at George Mason University and the author of Free to Move, Foot Voting, Migration, and Political Freedom. Ilya, we talked about interjurisdictional foot voting and we talked about private sector foot voting. I'd like to move on to international migration, particularly in light of what's transpiring today with Ukraine and so forth. I think there's much more of a focus on international migration. So let's talk about that. How does international foot voting impact political freedom?
It impacts it, I think, even more than foot voting within countries for a couple of reasons. One is, if you think about whatever you believe is the best governed American state and compare it to whatever you think is the worst, it might be a big difference, but it's not nearly as large as differences between countries often are. It's a much smaller difference and a difference between the United States and Cuba, the United States and Russia, where I'm originally from, of course, back then it was the Soviet Union, or the United States and China or North Korea and so on. These are huge, enormous differences, such that when people are able to move from one of these oppressive societies to a relatively freer one, there's an enormous transformation in virtually every aspect of human freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom to pursue economic opportunities and so forth. There's also an enormous increase in political freedom that for about one third to one half of the world's population who live under dictatorships, for them, foot voting through international migration is probably their only hope of exercising meaningful political choice at any time in the near future. They don't even have the very limited freedom of the ballot box that we have in Western democracies, where they can vote and have a 1 in 1 million or a 1 in 60 million chance of influencing the outcome of an election. And finally, there is an enormous benefit to the entire world in that if we were to eliminate all or nearly all barriers to international migration, economists estimate that world GDP would double. That is, the world would be about twice as productive as it currently is, because right now there are so many millions of people that are trapped in societies where the government is so oppressive or so corrupt or so otherwise dysfunctional that no matter how smart they are, how hard they work, they have almost no chance of escaping poverty. Whereas if people like this moved to the US or Western Europe or another relatively more successful and freer society, then they can almost immediately become much more productive. For Central Americans that moved to the US, for example, it's about 2 or 3 times more productive. And that doesn't even take account of how they can improve their skills over time, which can more easily be done in a wealthier and freer society. And that's an enormous benefit, not just to migrants themselves, but also to the people of the country they move to, and indeed to the entire world. A world that's wealthier and more productive is vastly better in many respects. It's likely to promote human freedom more. It's also likely to make us healthier and happier. To take just one example, the first two COVID vaccines that were approved by the US government, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, they were both developed either by immigrants from poor and oppressed nations or by the children thereof. If those people or their parents had been forced to remain in their countries of origin, we probably would not have gotten these vaccines, or we wouldn't have gotten them as quickly. As a result, hundreds of thousands or even millions of additional people would have died. And the same thing is true for a lot of other valuable innovations and improvements that have been made thanks to international migration. Immigrants, in fact, disproportionately contribute to scientific and other innovations.
To what degree do you recommend reducing migration restrictions or eliminating them completely?
So I would argue that what we should strive for is replacing the current system where there's a presumption of exclusion, that is, everybody who's not already a citizen or legal resident of a given country is presumed to be excluded unless the government gives them specific permission. I would replace that with a presumption of freedom of movement, similar to the one that we have within the United States. That is, that people should be able to live where they want and work what they want, unless there's very strong evidence that they pose some sort of threat, and that restricting freedom of movement is the only way to address that threat. So the kind of rules that currently govern whether you're allowed to move from one American state to another should, roughly speaking, govern the decision about whether you're allowed to move from one country to another. At the very least, that should be the presumption.
So if you're looking at a presumption, in effect, of innocence, or I think you referenced it as peaceful migration. How do you meter that? How do you know that the people coming in, if there isn't a vetting process, are in fact peaceful? Or do you find out after the fact, number one? Number two, if you do look at metering it at some point, what types of things do you think are legitimate ways to monitor people as they come in and make decisions?
So you can ask the same question about migration from California to Texas or vice versa. How do we know that the person moving from California to Texas isn't doing it for the purpose of committing a crime or being violent or even an act of terrorism or the like? And I think the answer is that with a presumption of liberty, what you do is instead of trying to vet every single person, you see if the government has specific evidence against particular individuals that they're planning to commit a crime or do something else very harmful. And then you can address that on a case-by-case basis. Moreover, with the vast additional wealth that can be created by free migration, if we need to, this all that wealth can be put into law enforcement resources in a more targeted way, address crime or terrorism or other sorts of problems. Indeed, just by taking the money currently spent on ICE and other similar agencies whose job is mostly to keep out peaceful migrants, if you take that and instead put it into traditional police agencies, then you could put a lot more police on the street and accomplish a lot more in terms of reducing violent and property crime of the kind that actually worries Americans, that actually harms people. Whereas people coming in for the purpose of living and working peacefully not only does not harm natives, but in fact greatly benefits them. So every time we spend a dollar, or in reality many billions of dollars, on excluding migrants, that's not money spent on ordinary law enforcement, and therefore it actually makes us less safe against crime and other similar problems rather than more safe.
Well, the theoretical example of moving between, say, New York and California, I think can be differentiated, and I'd like to hear your feedback on it, from moving from Syria or Afghanistan, which we've recently seen over the years, where there isn't really a fundamental database that would let us properly vet. So how do you accommodate that reality versus oppressively banning people who are innocent coming in from those types of countries? So how would you address that?
So when people move from New York to California, we do not in fact check them against the database to see if the government thinks that they're a problem or not. Rather, we only stop them if we have very strong specific evidence against a particular person. And I recognize, you know, if you let people in from Afghanistan or Syria or some other country, there is a risk a particular individual might be dangerous. The same thing is true, of course, of a native-born American moving from one state to another, even one town to another. Statistically speaking, immigrants, including immigrants from Afghanistan and Syria, actually have lower violent crime rates than native-born Americans do. So if the danger that someone moving from California to Texas might be a criminal is not enough to have a general presumption restricting freedom of movement between those two places, then the same thing should be true of freedom of movement from one country to another. And I would add, as I mentioned earlier, that on net, we can actually do more to reduce violent crime and terrorism and similar problems by investing in traditional law enforcement resources than by investing in immigration restrictions. So if you're worried about violent or property crime, then there is a case for spending more money on ordinary police, and there's much more payoff to that than spending money on immigration restrictions.
Ilya, we're going to take another quick break and talk more about foot voting when we come back. Welcome back. My guest today is Ilya Soman, professor of law at George Mason University and the author of Free to Move, Foot Voting, Migration, and Political Freedom. Ilya, we were talking about international migration, and you bring up an issue in your book called the sovereignty argument. Can you discuss that?
Yes. So a lot of people say that governments have a right to exclude migrants from abroad whenever they want, because that's just the inherent element of what it means to be a sovereign government. And while this argument is often advanced, I think it's actually very weak. First, I think one big problem with it is that powers of government are not self-justifying. We shouldn't ask, is this a power of government? Rather, we should ask, should this be a power of government? How is it justified? And from this perspective, if this power in fact causes more injustice and harm than benefit, then maybe it should be gotten rid of or at least curtailed. And I would add that there's a long history of people considering something to be an inherent power of sovereignty that it turns out the world would be better off without because it's actually unjust. For example, throughout most of history, most people assume that governments, if they want, can suppress religion and speech that they disapprove of, particularly speech that criticized the government or advocated changing it. It was generally assumed that a king or a prince had the right to suppress that. Many provisions of international law for a long time assumed that they could suppress religions they disapproved of and so forth. There's equally a long history of the idea that governments can impose forced labor on their populations. If the government thinks it's really important to build a particular road or bridge or something else, then they could draft forced laborers to do it. And today we recognize that these powers should not be allowed to governments because they're deeply unjust. And no one would today say, oh, but in order to be a sovereign, it has to use the power to suppress speech or the power to restrict religion or impose forced labor and the like. To the contrary, we recognize that these powers should be denied by governments because the purpose of government is not to have power for its own sake, is to promote human freedom and well-being. And giving governments powers that actually undermine freedom and well-being not only is unnecessary, but is actually harmful and defeats the very purposes for which governments are supposed to exist in the first place. And restricting migration is just such a power. It severely restricts human freedom. It destroys a lot of economic growth and innovation that we would otherwise get. And it's a power of government that discriminates against people based on who their parents are or where they were born, which within countries, we readily recognize that shouldn't be permitted or should be severely limited. And obviously, in many cases, it's also used to discriminate on the basis of race, religion, or ethnicity. Indeed, many immigration restrictions, if you look at their history, they have their origins and prejudices like that. So if we believe, as I think most of us do, that domestically, governments should not have the power to say only certain people can live in a certain place, they can only live there if they had the right parents or they belong to the right ethnic or racial group, we condemn that kind of domestic segregation or that kind of apartheid, then the power of international segregation and apartheid is also one that government should not have.
And how do you respond to the brain drain theory that people should stay home and fix their own countries that we hear so frequently?
I'm glad you asked about that. I would respond to it in two ways. First, the rulers of the home country of a person, they don't own that person. They can't force that person to work against his or her will. And therefore, even if losing that person's brain, so to speak, is bad for the country, that brain doesn't belong to a nation, it belongs to the person to whom it's attached. That follows from the standard argument against forced labor and slavery. If you really believe that brain drain is a reason for coercing people to stay, you must also believe that it's a reason for coercing them to take the jobs that the government thinks they should have. After all, if a particular person's brain is most valuable by them working as an engineer, but they choose to be an artist or something else, then the brain is drained just as much as if the person goes abroad. I would in addition argue that empirically, allowing emigration often is actually good for the sending country in two ways. One is poor nations that have diasporas in wealthy ones, the people who move abroad, they often send back remittances to their relatives back home. And that can be a significant increase in their income. In a country like El Salvador, it's about 25% or more, the entire national income. And in addition, when a country that's underdeveloped or oppressive, when they have a diaspora of their former citizens living in freer society, there's communication between the emigrants, the people who left, and their relatives and friends left behind. That spreads ideas and can create pressure for liberalization in the home country. There is some social science evidence which shows that. More generally, competition for people between jurisdictions can help improve the government policy in those jurisdictions because they will want to avoid losing taxpayers and losing productive people. It doesn't always work perfectly by any means, but it's certainly better than if the government can in effect lock up its people and prevent them from leaving on the theory that otherwise there would be a brain drain.
The remittance argument that you shared mitigates in some regard against the redistribution of wealth argument that I've also heard and that you address in your book, where people are suggesting that wealthy countries have a moral imperative to redistribute their wealth and it would be more cost effective than absorbing people across their borders. Speak to that issue for us.
The assumption on which this theory rests is just wrong. The idea is that sending a lot of money to poor nations will lift them up from poverty. And in most cases, that just isn't true, because the root of the poverty in most of these places is the oppressive, dysfunctional, and corrupt nature of the governments that these people live under. If you give more money to those very governments, they're likely to squander it for some of the same reasons that those governments are dysfunctional in the first place. Or even worse, they might use the money to perpetuate their very system that created the poverty in the first place. By contrast, if people are allowed to move freely, first, the people who themselves move, they obviously can escape the poverty. But second, through remittances, which don't go through the existing dysfunctional government, they can help lift some of their relatives up from poverty in a way that's much better than foreign aid. If you want a great anti-poverty program, there is no better one in the entire history of the world than letting people migrate freely. That has lifted many more people out of poverty than foreign aid and redistribution ever has, or probably ever will.
Those are great insights. Ilya, in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about you, your writings and appearances, and pick up a copy of Free to Move?
Sure. The easiest way to buy a copy of Free to Move is at the Amazon website or other similar websites, where you can even get the new edition of the book, which includes some new issues, and can get that at a significant discount. Just go for the paperback. There's also a Kindle version, which you can get for just $9.99. If you prefer, you can instead buy it at the Oxford University Press website, which is my publisher, and it's available at some physical bookstores as well. If you want to learn about me and my work more generally, I have a website linked to my university, George Mason. Just Google my name. You can easily find my website. My last name is spelled S-O, M as in Michael, I, N as in Nancy. I also write regularly for the Volok Conspiracy blog, which is hosted by Reason Magazine. Volok is spelled V-O-L-O-K-H, and my writings there are available for free. And if you go to my website, you can see also a lot of free writings of other kinds. And I have academic articles, but also articles for popular media like the Washington Post, USA Today, the Wall Street Journal, and others.
Ilya Sohman, professor of law at George Mason University and the author of Free to Move, Foot Voting, Migration, and Political Freedom. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show. I wish I would have had you as a professor when I was back in law school. I think we would have had some interesting discussions. I hope you'll come back so we can talk about another one of your books, Democracy and Political Ignorance. And Ilya, thank you again for joining me on Deconstructed.
Thank you for having me.